At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Come on, admit it. You're excited about the Fed meeting too, aren't you? If you're not, you ought to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 18th of June. Glad to have you here. And I'll tell you, gang, for the first time in a good long while, there's a meeting of the Federal Reserve going on today and tomorrow that people are actually giddy about. The kind of people who get giddy about Fed meetings anyway. It's all about interest rates, of course, the federal funds rate, the key interest rate the Fed controls directly, but also its bond buying program, quantitative easing, through which Mr. Bernanke and company have been funneling tens of billions of dollars a month into the economy. But with the economy slowly but surely recovering, there's a lot of pressure on the Fed to back off. So the big question, and hence all the giddiness, is how they're going to do that. Will the Fed taper or tighten? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains the difference.
To tighten or to taper? That's the question on Wall Street these days, says Paul Kodrosky, senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation.
So tapering is the Fed consciously reducing the amount of quantitative easing that it's doing. So it's tapering off its purchasing.
In other words, the Fed's multi-billion-dollar bond buying program would be gradually stepped down, and interest rates would stay more or less where they are.
Tapering means a little bit less. Tightening means a full 180.
Michael Farr is chief investment officer at Farr, Miller & Washington.
They would actually reverse the process. They could start selling bonds from their portfolio, or they could raise interest rates.
Economist Max Wolf doubts that will happen. He says whatever the Fed decides to call its policy, it's going to be a gradual change.
What we're really debating is whether the language is aggressive or moderate. The policy will be quite moderate.
Wolf says the Fed might choose to use strong language to quiet critics. Strong policy probably won't fly, he says, because the economy is still fragile. And if the training wheels come off too soon, there could be dire effects.
We could have a shock that could be quite negative economically, and could create spikes in things like credit card interest rates, auto loan rates, home mortgage rates.
Which could undo the small amount of economic growth we're seeing right now, push us back into a recession, and require the Fed to start untightening or untapering. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Since what's basically going on here is wordplay, we went to three people whose business is words to ask what they thought about this whole thing. Authors Jeffrey Eugenides, Mary Beth Keene, and Jess Walter.
Taper is the more elegant word. We might describe a well-tailored suit as being tapered. It suggests sophistication, precision. Tighten, on the other hand, is what you do to the waist of your sweatpants.
First impressions, taper is a gentle word. Tighten, on the other hand, is a violent word. The killer tightens his hands around his victim's throat. It implies an action the victim can't see coming, whereas taper offers fair warning.
Personally, I find taper a more interesting word than tighten. It's more nuanced, shows some reticence on the part of the speaker. It's less common and more specific, and to me, the sound's much more appealing. If I was Bernanke, I'd throw a bit of surrealism into the mix. He should come out and say, "We've decided the best course is to taper. But by that, I mean taper with an eye, to behave like those pig-like animals with the prehensile snouts common to South America." He should then refuse to answer any questions and see what the market makes of that.
How much would you pay to see the markets on that day, right? Jess Walter, at the end there for us, his most recent book is called We Live in Water. Mary Beth Keene wrote Fever. Jeffrey Eugenides started it off. His latest book is called The Marriage Plot. In the markets this day, traders were betting on the come after that Fed meeting that ends tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Obesity in this country is a problem. It's growing and it's expensive. Best guesses are more than $200 billion a year for everything from related illnesses like high blood pressure and diabetes to lost work days. At its annual meeting today in Chicago, the American Medical Association voted to recognize obesity as a disease. The decision isn't technically binding on anybody, but when the AMA speaks, policymakers often listen. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
Dr. Ethan Lazarus sees about 600 patients a year at his weight loss clinic in Denver, Colorado. Don't tell him obesity is a lifestyle choice.
Most of my patients have tried to lose weight 12 or 14 times, and I'm treating cardiologists, emergency room doctors, family doctors, CEOs of companies. These are the most highly motivated people.
Lazarus says for some of his patients, it wouldn't get to that point if they had more preventative services, like time with dietitians and access to prescription drugs. A report out of Emory University suggests spending on obesity could reach $350 billion before the end of this decade. Dr. Jeffrey Kane is the president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Kane says the AMA designating obesity as a disease could push insurers to start paying for some of the straightforward preventable services.
Money on preventing obesity and preventing the downstream things like diabetes and high blood pressure and amputations and things, not only is that ultimately cheaper for our country, but it's better for our patients.
It's also a lot better for the doctors who treat obesity, says Emory University health policy professor David Howard.
Saying that obesity is a disease will possibly open up the floodgate and make it much harder for insurers to deny payment.
Now that the AMA has endorsed the change, the lobbying of lawmakers and insurers begins. The question is whether more preventative services will drive up costs or lower them. Howard says if history's any guide, more services typically means more money. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We got the latest figures on industrial production a couple of days ago. Factory output is another way to think of that. I'll give you the number, even though it's kind of meaningless all by itself, up a tenth of 1%. What's more relevant, probably, is the history of American manufacturing, and you gotta hope its future. Edward McClelland grew up right in the heart of that history, Lansing, Michigan, and the car industry back in the 70s and 80s. His new book about that place in that time is called Nothing But Blue Skies. Edward, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Tell me about your high school, would you?
My high school, it's called J.W. Sexton High School in Lansing, Michigan. And it was directly across the street from a Fisher body plant. The high school was completely integrated into the industrial life of Michigan to the point where people could walk across the street and just get a job right out of high school.
You actually asked this question, and you do it early on in this book. You say, I assumed universal prosperity was the natural condition of American life. And,
right.
And clearly you're not sure that continues to be the case.
Right. I mean, we were on sort of a geometric pattern of growth, say, between 1948 and 1973. And then came the Arab oil embargo. All of a sudden, people wanted to drive small cars. And the American auto companies didn't want to make small cars. And when they did, they made terrible small cars. They made the Pinto. They made the Vega. They made my first car, the Chevette.
I had a 1972 Oldsmobile Cutlass 442 convertible.
Now, that was a sweet car.
Red with a white top. That was a sweet car, and honestly, the stupidest thing I ever did was sell it. But that's a whole different interview. It does, though, kind of talk to how iconic American manufacturing became.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was what we were. It was what we did. And now we kind of don't do that anymore.
Manufacturing was so much a part of the identity and part of the economy of these towns. I was just in Flint this week, and Flint was a town where 2/3 of the people depended on General Motors for their livelihood. And Flint has gone from probably 80,000 auto workers in the late 1970s to 7,500 today. So even if you can replace those jobs, you can't replace those jobs with other middle-class jobs.
Tell me about that Fisher body plant now, though. What it looked like the last time you went back to Sexton High School?
It looked like a cross between Nagasaki and the Badlands. And I remember a sign on the fence as they were tearing it down that said, "Demolition means progress." Although what I found out was that this was actually one of the more hopeful or promising stories, because the plant was torn down not because they were pulling out of town, but because it was obsolete.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't as many jobs as there were when I was growing up. At one time, there were 25,000 auto workers in Lansing, and now there are 5,000. But I think that has as much to do with automation as anything else.
Yeah, but automation and the way manufacturing has changed is the guts of this story, right? I mean, this is a book about people, but behind it is the way that manufacturing in this country has changed.
Well, it's that, and it's also foreign competition. When I was starting to look for a job in the early 90s and having a difficult time, I was fascinated with stories of these factory veterans from the 50s and the 60s who they got right out of high school, and within a year they had enough money to buy a house, to support a family. And America really was in a position that I don't think this country or any other country is ever going to be in again. And I think we have enough perspective on it now to ask, well, was the great American middle class that we took for granted as the American way of life, was that just a moment in history that we're never going to see again?
The latest book by Ted McClelland is called Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Ted, thanks a bunch.
All right, thank you.
Coming up,
I think our audience understands if they want a music video that they really want, they're going to go online immediately.
So what exactly does the CEO of MTV do then? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials pumped up 0.9% today, 138 points, closed at 15,318. The NASDAQ advanced 0.8%, that's 30 points. Finished at 3482. The S&P 500 climbed 0.75%, 12 points, 1651 on that particular index. Financial firms found the upside. Citigroup pocketed 1.33%. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley deposited 0.4%. Despite some good news on housing starts, housing stocks were mixed. Toll Brothers built up more than 1%. Lennar and KB Home traded flat, but there was no confusion about the need for an easy chair to go in those homes. Shares in Lazy Boy shot up more than 6% in anticipation of a good earnings report. General Electric brightened up more than 2.33% today. Bond prices, well, they barely budge. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee talks about improving passenger and freight rail safety. How much stuff is getting overnighted? FedEx releases quarterly earnings. And it's World Sauntering Day. So slow down, people! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Sometimes it doesn't take much to get a protest going. And once you get that seemingly little thing, everything else comes pouring out. Case in point, Brazil and higher bus fares. There were some minor protests over that earlier this month. Police cracked down. And then by last night, hundreds of thousands of people were marching through more than a half a dozen cities in Brazil, angry over everything from government corruption to poor public spending choices. The BBC's Gary Duffy has the story for us from Sao Paulo.
The protests last night were on a scale beyond anything Brazil has seen for decades. One newspaper here caught the breadth of the concerns being raised. Thousands take to the streets against everything, it said. The huge spending on the hosting of the 2014 Soccer World Cup and Olympics was an issue raised by many on the streets, who feel their education and health services don't deliver.
We're here because we're tired of so much corruption. We're here because we want to change Brazil.
What began as a protest against higher public transport fares has now broadened considerably. And the challenge to Brazil's political leaders was at its clearest when demonstrators got onto the roof of the National Congress building in the capital, Brasilia. Brazil is one of the most important developing economies in the world, but it seems like more and more of its people feel they are being shortchanged.
The money is only for the World Cup and for football, and people are suffering that.
President Dilma Rousseff has praised those who protested peacefully and says the country woke up stronger this morning. The government says it is listening to what are legitimate concerns. But with Brazil due to be at the centre of major international sporting events, the protesters are keeping up the pressure, with more demonstrations planned. In Sao Paulo, I'm the BBC's Gary Duffy for Marketplace.
Remember I was talking about people who get giddy about Fed meetings up at the top of the program? Well, if you really want to see those people lose it, start talking about who's going to replace Ben Bernanke if and when he decides he's done. The president himself stoked the fire in an interview with Charlie Rose last night when he said Mr. Bernanke has stayed longer than he wanted to as Fed chairman. For some time now, informed speculation, such as it is on high-profile jobs like these, has been that Janet Yellen, the current vice chair at the Fed, would get the promotion. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has our profile.
Janet Yellen is a tiny lady, 66 years old, short white hair, slight Brooklyn accent. Here she is in 2009 preparing an audience for some slightly positive economic news in the middle of the recession.
I spent the last year or so, I have to confess, being so downbeat that when I looked at the faces of my audience, I could actually see them sinking as I spoke.
For those who know her, that sense of humor is a lifelong defining characteristic.
In contrast to a lot of people in positions of such importance, you know, she has a kind of humility, a kind of down-to-earthness.
Joe Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. Yellen studied under him at Yale, where she was known for her notes, which were so good she was asked to turn them into a book.
Her background is it was very much, you might say, micro-based macroeconomics. That is to say, it has a very nuanced view of how the economy operates.
As a professor, Yellen's work is focused on unemployment. In one well-known paper, she made the, at the time, new argument that people's sense of fairness was an important factor in labor productivity. As a Fed governor, she was known as an impressive debater, once arguing Alan Greenspan into agreeing that a little bit of inflation was a good thing.
Janet's a very disarming person.
Kevin Hassett, now at the American Enterprise Institute, was a staffer at the Fed when Yellen was a governor there in the early 90s.
She was unique among the governors in that she would come hang out in the lunchroom with the staff.
It was at that lunchroom that she'd met her husband, Nobel Prize-winning economist George Akerlof. For Hassett, one thing that sticks out is that Yellen required her staffers to calculate what the Fed policy would be if it followed the advice of her critics.
You know, now that's kind of a regular practice at the Fed.
Now, the Federal Reserve is charged by Congress with controlling both unemployment and inflation. Fed officials are often accused of having a bias towards dealing with one or the other.
I think it probably is a fair reading that she's more concerned about high unemployment. And I think that there are folks who have a genuine concern that unless you have a real inflation hawk at the Fed, that inflation could spin out of control, as it did, say, in the 70s.
That's perhaps the most widely heard criticism of Yellen, but it's also a contentious one.
Janet is enormously pragmatic. She's not ideological.
Joe Stiglitz.
She will look at the situation as it exists. Right now, the situation is that we don't face any inflation problems, and the situation is that we face a serious unemployment problem.
Inflation's averaged 2% since Yellen began at the Fed, and she's presided over two rounds of interest rate hikes. She said she would do it again if needed. There's another moment that stands out in her track record at the Fed.
She was one of the, I think, most perceptive members, even in late 2007, which is before the economy tanked.
Steve Oliner worked at the Department of Commerce and had to report regularly to Yellen, whom he calls a very demanding boss. He says in 2007, hers was one of the few voices at the Fed sounding the alarm bells.
She was very concerned about the possibility that the financial crisis would cause a recession and that there could be really deep and severe problems in the financial system.
At the time, Yellen called the housing sector the 600-pound gorilla in the room. She advocated for a half-point interest rate cut. Unconvinced, and soon to be proven wrong, the Fed would go with a quarter-point reduction. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Rapper Jay-Z has a new album coming out early next month, and he's already sold a million copies of the thing to Samsung, the phone people. Marketplace's Adrian Hill checks out what that might mean for the future of digital media, if anything.
Jay-Z is a pretty brilliant businessman.
I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman.
Okay, a pretty brilliant businessman.
We don't have any rules. Everyone's trying to figure it out. That's why the internet is like the Wild West. The Wild Wild West. We need to write the new rules.
And his reported $5 million deal with Samsung is a sweet rule rewrite for him. But what's in it for Samsung?
By aligning themselves with Jay-Z, possibly the coolest man on the planet, Samsung hopes to, you know, have a little bit of a little cool shrapnel land on them.
Max Dawson is a media consultant with Frank in Magid Associates. Samsung will hand out a million copies of Jay-Z's new album, Magna Carta Holy Grail, to its users via app 3 days before the album drops. And we could see more of these exclusive content deals between mobile phones and megastars. Philip Napoli is a communications professor at Fordham School of Business.
Content can potentially be leveraged as essentially a way to differentiate different devices from each other.
Maybe we should call it the Jay-Z-ing of the mobile industry.
I said, yeah, I turned you into a verb. He's like, always wanted to be a verb.
I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Music, maybe more than, but certainly just as much as anything else at least, helps define a generation. And since it first went on the air more than 30 years ago, MTV has been the voice for the young, which is a problem because we all keep getting older. Those teenagers who were watching the first time MTV was on are pushing 50 now. So the network's got a whole new audience, the millennials. Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, keeping up with the younger generation, whoever they may be. Stephen Friedman is the president of MTV. Mr. Friedman, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Kai.
So I won't start this the way I usually start an interview, because I'm going to insult you a little bit. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about talking to you, and he said almost verbatim, "Man, whatever happened to MTV anyway?" Now, this was not a young guy, but still.
I'm glad to hear he's not in our demo.
That's right.
Because the thing about MTV, which you know, makes it different than just about any other media brand, is we have to let go of each generation as they graduate out of it. And, you know, with our sweet spot, our broad demo, 12 to 34, but really our sweet spot, 18 to 24, we have the luxury of just thinking about this audience. So I hope your friend is older than 34.
he is. But wait, why do you guys have to change and adjust all the time? Because the Rolling Stones are still playing and they're 65-something years old. I mean, it's not like music goes away when you get old.
True, but check out their audience and the, you know, the 40, 50, 60-year-olds who are there. it's not our demo. And so I think for us, it is being rigorous to this notion of always connecting with the new young generation. But that means constant reinvention.
Whatever happened to the M in MTV? When was the last time you guys did music videos, for crying out loud? You know?
Every morning. You can see our
every
videos.
Morning between 7 and 9. But you know, otherwise it's reality programming and all of that stuff.
Well, I think, and this is another generational issue. I think our audience understands if they want a music video that they really want, they're going to go online immediately. The idea, you know, I grew up. I'm an Xer. I grew up waiting for that unbelievable Michael Jackson premiere of Thriller. I think the world, wow. Young world, was riveted by that. The idea that our audience is going to wait around for a video in a couple of, you know, in an hour or a half hour, it just doesn't exist. Our audience wants the immediacy of it. So for us, it's about having the most robust online presence of music, but also weaving it out throughout our shows. We give it to our audience, but in multiple ways across a myriad of platforms.
I want to try something with you that I've tried with a couple of other CEOs, none of whom have gotten it right. Do me a favor and tell me what your company does in 5 words or less.
5 words or less.
It's not easy, right?
Let's see. Is this 5 words or less? We aim to be the cultural home of the millennial generation.
All right, I think that was 11. I lost count. But you can trim it down. Cultural home of millennial generation.
Of the millennial
right?
generation.
There you go.
How's that?
Right, I'll take that cultural marketing home, job from your marketing staff right now.
There you go. There That's you go. Five, right?
Yeah, it is. Stephen Friedman, CEO of MTV. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Great talking with you, Kai.
Take a second. Share your favorite MTV memory, no matter how old you are. Tell us on Facebook or on Twitter, at Marketplace APM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the handwriting of Treasury Secretary Jack Lew plays a prominent role. One of the bennies, of course, of having that job is that your signature goes on money. Problem is, the Jack Lew signature is weird, to say the least. A sequence of swirls and loops that honestly look more like they were done on a spirograph than by hand. Anyway, Mr. Lew has changed his signature to conform to the protocols of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. That is, made it vaguely legible. Secretary Lew is by no means the first Treasury Secretary to have gotten in trouble over his penmanship. You can hear my chat with Timothy Geithner on the same subject and see what changes Jack Lew made to his at marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 0.9%, about 138 points. The NASDAQ advanced 0.8%, 30 points. The S&P 500 gained 0.75%, 12 points. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Hone, Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.